I'm Bill Rice.
And this is our second session in discussing faith, culture, and mission. To get a feel for how much we should review, how many of you here were not here yesterday? Okay, just a few of you. We'll just jump rather quickly over some of the concepts that we covered yesterday. I've been fascinated to see how the things that we've been talking about here interplay with some of the other things that have been going on here at Holden Village. Gary Pence's presentation last evening, yesterday afternoon, Renee Pearson. There have been several points of contact. Yesterday we looked at culture, and we saw that culture could be described in three levels. Material culture, including our technology, all of the things in matter, things in nature which we deal with and interact with. The tools, our houses, our buildings, the way we deal with the physical world. And then a second level, social, political, economic. The way we interact with each other. Our social classes or castes or stratifications, the way we organize ourselves into groups and societies, families, churches, states, nations, our economy, the way we share and interchange and distribute goods and services, our communication systems, and so on. But the level of culture that we became most interested in was the level that made sense of all that. The level at which we not only do these things, but we think about and reflect upon and understand what we are doing. That is the level of meaning. And we saw that the meaning level of culture, which is the group of stories, symbols, ideas, concepts, values that tell us where we have been, who we are as a people, who is included in our group and who isn't, who we can trust, who we cannot trust, what is the purpose of life, what is fulfillment, where are we going, what is the future. All of these meanings are directly related or are the basic type of thing that our faith is. Let's change colors on faith. Red a good color for faith? I guess it's... So there's a direct interaction here. And insofar as we understand our faith dealing not strictly with, quote, religious, unquote, issues, but dealing with the levels of meaning of life, then it is going to interface with our cultural meanings. It is going to inform them or challenge them. Then we looked at Christian mission. And the concept of Christian mission brought so many ideas and words to your mind that we didn't have space on the entire board to put them down. But we saw that we could, except for the unintended cultural and sociological consequences of the mission enterprise, that we could divide the intended focus of Christian mission into three major activities. Remember what they were?
Evangelism,
service,
church building,
and service.
Switch the order on you. Okay. Evangelism is telling a new story about the world. It is presenting a new set of meanings. It is proclaiming the gospel, the good news. And so evangelism is a direct confrontation with or a direct transformation of the meanings by which we live. In church building, we bring together those people who say amen to that new vision and say, yes, I choose not only to see my world that way, but I choose to live my life according to this vision of the world.
So church building is the bringing
together of those people who have adopted that new set of meanings. And in the same process, it's creating an institution that did not exist before.
So church building directly affects not only the meaning level of culture, but the social, political, economic level.
And we saw this yesterday in Rene Pearson's discussion of the role of the church in the workers' movements of Korea, where for a period of time at least, the church was very active in assisting in the formation and development of labor unions. Then, we're not only interested in proclaiming the gospel and drawing people together who say, yes, we shall live by this good news, but we are to become the gospel. We are to become healing to the sick, food to the hungry, help to those who need it.
And so the service level of mission, again, affects our meanings, it affects our institutions, and it affects our material well-being.
Mission is directly involved with the transformation of culture. Even when we looked at the very narrow definition of mission in the missionary waves of the 19th century, and we saw that the focus was on individual and personal salvation, the rescuing of the heathen from damnation. It was inescapable that there were cultural consequences to that. One could not simply change a little bit of the meaning here without affecting the entire package and the social, political, and economic conditions as well. In fact, mission can be this interaction with culture and its positive aspects and its negative aspects can be dramatized by two polar statements. One is to say that mission is the handmaid of Westernization, which is involved in the systematic destruction of the meanings of traditional cultures. And the other is to say that mission is the proclamation of the good news, bringing all people into the family of God and becoming the gospel manifest. Both statements on totally opposite extremes nevertheless show that mission is inescapable from mission inescapably interacts with the fundamental meanings of a culture. Okay. Then we decided to come down from the abstract a bit and look at a specific people. We were talking about the Batak people of North Sumatra, who were famed as a fearsome, cannibalistic, warlike tribe that the Dutch East India Company in 200 years had not been able to subdue. We saw how early mission efforts resulted in at least two of the missionaries being victims of this cannibalism. And we did see how one man, a Ludwig Nomundsen, was able to enter Batak country with a totally different vision of what life might be among this tribe. And as a result of his vision and his taking very seriously the meanings by which the people lived, he was able to discover within their midst and within their institutions, and we'll look at that a little more closely, the activity of the Spirit and a basis for building the church. In the decades which followed Nomundsen's arrival, the church grew the church quadrupled every decade. And now, about 60% of all Batak people, it is estimated, are Christians. That's probably then in the neighborhood of 1 to 1.5 million people. Let's look a little bit, in a little more detail, at what the traditional culture of the Batak was like before this interaction of the Christian faith. And we'll concentrate on looking at the meanings that the people lived by.
Yesterday we mentioned the term sahala, spiritual power. That is the power that accrues to a person by virtue of his own skills and abilities, by virtue of his or her relationship with other people. There are stories that are told that when the fetus is in the womb, the fetus is talking with Om Putu Anbubi Nabolon, that's the high god. I expect you to remember that. And carries on this discussion with Om Putu Anbubi Nabolon about what kind of sahala he or she should have. And those who are patient and willing to wait at least a year can get a good sahala, a sahala of many talents and many skills, a sahala to have many descendants, a sahala to be a generous person. Those, however, who are impatient to be born may have to content themselves with a thief sahala, or a robber sahala, or a liar sahala. So the sahala expresses not only the powers of the person, but something of the character. Teachers bear sahala to their students, and so students respect teachers. Parents bear sahala to their children. My wife's relatives bear sahala toward me. It's a wonderful concept if we could get that involved in the concept of mother-in-law and father-in-law in our country. But in-laws bear sahala to you. Another fundamental concept is the spirit of the person himself. Now, the sahala is not the spirit. The sahala describes qualities of the spirit, but the spirit is the tondi. The tondi is the essential person. When you go to sleep at night, if you dream, your tondi is wandering around having these many experiences. If you are sick, your tondi has left your body, and the effort of healing is to bring the tondi back to the body. In death, the tondi leaves the body permanently and becomes a begu. A begu is this third concept. Now, a begu is not fundamentally different from a tondi. A begu is a spirit that does not have a body. So, the ancestors who have died are now begu. But so also are the spirits of trees and waterfalls and streams. The solobeo are very friendly begu, the begu of the waters and the streams that fertilize the land. The begu anto is not so friendly, he brings cholera. Begu are not fundamentally different, or the spirits then of nature and the spirits of people are not fundamentally different in their substance and nature. There's an interesting story of a begu who wanted to steal a man's wife, and so he appeared in the form of the woman's husband and came to earth and tried to take her away. Well, when the husband confronted the begu, there was a great fight, and the matter got brought to the medicine man, who said, okay, we're going to find out which one of you is the real husband. Whoever can go through this bamboo log may have the woman as his wife. Well, the real husband was just dismayed because he couldn't squeeze himself down and get through that log. But the begu changed his shape, and he squeezed himself down small, and he scooted into the log, whereupon the witnesses quickly closed up both ends, threw the log on the fire, and the problem was resolved. One of the great values that the Batak people, one of the words they love is the word pandi, which means clever. And that's reflected in many of their stories, and it's reflected in much of the way they live. There are other symbols, or many. We could talk for hours about the Batak people, but one of the symbols that appears again and again and again in their writings, in their talking, in their stories, is the symbol of the tree. The tree is the tree of life, and all people are part of the tree of life.
There is a tree in planted at the grave, that at every grave trees are planted from the cuttings of trees that are at the ancestors' graves. There's a tree in every village. There's a pole that runs up through each house, which symbolizes the tree of life. The tree has its roots down in the watery underworld, and its trunk in the world in which we dwell here, and its branches stretch up into the heavens. And in the heavens lives the high god, Om Putu Ambubina Bolom. If I say it often enough, I'll remember it too. Then there is the god of the middle world and the god of the underworld. And the three primary gods are called Devatana Tolu, the three god. Now you can already see where we're going, can't you? Okay. With the coming of the missionaries, there are many very complex interactions between what the missionaries saw and said and spoke of and what the Batak experienced. Now these interactions, I think, can fit into four main patterns. Remember, we talked about symbols and meanings, where a symbol is a vehicle. It can be anything. It can be a concept. It can be a physical sign. It can be a story. It can be a myth. It can be a hero. It can be anything at all. But we refer to it as a symbol insofar as it stands not alone, but it is a pointer, it is a vehicle for another idea, and is the meaning that is that other idea, which is of essence. So as the Christian missionaries interacted with Batak culture, there were several things that could happen. One is that the old old symbols and meanings persist. Oh, that sounds simple enough. But it was often the source of a great deal of surprise to the missionaries, that old things would persist. In fact, even today, it is not uncommon within the Christian communities of the Batak for a childless woman to go to the grave of, or the monument of, one of her great ancestors and to pray for a blessing so that she might be able to have children. At a burial, it's also not uncommon for there to be dancing around the coffin with scooping movements of the dancers, which in former times and perhaps even now reflect a sense of being able to draw some of the spiritual power, some of the sahala, from the deceased person. When a baby is born, occasionally an obstruction is placed in the doorway to confuse and ward off spirits. The most dramatic persistence of old symbols and meanings in my experience occurred at the church of which I was pastor. It was an English language church. It catered to the educated elite in the area. There were not only Batak, but also Chinese and Indian and many other peoples there, and a lot of Europeans. And the church for many years had been, well, since its inception, had been pastored by foreign missionaries. If we were to attend a service at that church today, we would feel very much at home. The people had a Western stamp. The church had a Western stamp. I had a regular Wednesday evening Bible study discussion group. And one Wednesday, after a week in which I had really had my mind stretched by witnessing a case where one of the employees in a printing shop at which I also worked had nearly died, and then he had been healed by the intercession of a medium who had surrendered herself to the voice of an ancestor and so on, and this whole thing. Okay. I'll tell that story later, maybe. Anyway, I had been really sensitized to this whole question of spirits and demons, so I announced on a Sunday morning that our Wednesday evening group was going to discuss demons, spirits, and the power of the Holy Spirit. Ordinarily, 5 or 6 people came on a Wednesday evening. Well, that Wednesday, everybody came. My preparations were totally unnecessary, for people just came out with story after story after story of events, of people who had been demon-possessed, of jilted lovers who had hexed their former lovees, causing a great deal of harm, of people witnessing healings and being able to see the demons running down the arms and off the fingers of persons being healed. Story after story after story. Among people who had talked to me about their visits to Singapore and to San Francisco and to London. Well, what I discovered from that was that there is nothing implicit in the coming or the bringing of a new symbolic system or of a new meaning system which says that it must destroy the old. The church came and it did provide important meanings to them in the areas of interpersonal relations, how people should live with each other, morality and ethics, the afterlife, and the life of the spirit. It did not, however, say anything of great importance about physical healing or emotional stress. And so the old symbolic system, which had been for centuries dealing with physical illness and emotional stress, simply persisted. There was no reason for it to change. From this, we can become academic and say, we'll draw up a principle, the conservation of symbols and meanings, to say that the old meaning framework, that which makes sense of our confusing world, is going to continue to make sense of our confusing world until there is some problem or anomaly with that which causes us to look for some new interpretation. But the mere presence of a new word, a mere presence of alternate ideas, is not going to change the way we organize our experience. Now, the exact opposite happened, and here we'll have our first big exception to the rule. For when the church came to Batak land, you had buildings with steeples and bells, pastors with robes, congregations meeting every Sunday morning to worship, church school classes, the Eucharist celebrated. You have a whole bunch of new institutions, new activities, new practices, new symbols, new meanings, even German brass bands. The Batak people love to get a hold of brass instruments, and they form German brass bands, and they march on Easter Sunday morning with their brass bands, and other times too. Whole new symbols and meanings which were not at all rooted in their own culture, have nothing to do with their own culture, and yet which they must learn, and or which they do learn, and which they do adopt, and becomes part of them. They adopt a new history, a new people. They learn of Israel and its history. They learn of the of conflicts over the creeds. They learn of Martin Luther. They learn of issues which were never issues to them, but now become their issues. They learn a history which was never their history and now becomes their history. Well, this is possible because there is nothing within the indigenous culture which directly opposes and conflicts it. And what makes it also possible is that the missionaries were not interested in going to Batak land simply to patch up their worldview. Say, well, let's offer you a few concepts here to see if we can take care of the anomalies of your experience. The missionaries didn't have that in mind at all. The missionaries are approaching the Christianization of the Batak with the concept, there is a whole new belonging here. Once you were no people, now you are God's people. You now are wrapped into a community, a worldwide community, that involves not merely fixing up a few ideas in your system, but being adopted by an entire family. So the history of that family and that family's symbols and meanings become part of our history. So although symbols and meanings will not change merely because there is something else present, they may change because part of adopting the faith involves adopting a whole new set of understandings of who we are. Where things really get interesting, however, let's get that here too. I'm just going to put S and M for symbols and meanings. Now, where things really get fun is where we have new symbols. New symbols adopted, but to them are attached the old meanings. The missionaries were very much concerned that the Eucharist might be closely associated with cannibalistic ideas. They were also concerned that the Eucharist might be just too closely associated with the concept of eating meals. And so the missionaries limited the Eucharistic celebrations to 4 times a year, and later on to only 2 or 3 times a year, so that it would not become secularized, so that its meaning would continue to be significant and important. And they exceeded well beyond their wildest dreams. For the elements of the Eucharist now took on that great significant meaning which had always been attached to things of importance by the Batak. The elements had sahala. And so the parishioners would be taking the little wafers or the bits of bread and so on, they'd stick them in their pockets and go home and put them up in the attic, the upper world, the attic of their houses, so that the great spiritual power of the elements would continue to bless them. Chalices disappeared rather rapidly. The pastor's robe became an important accoutrement that had to be carefully protected and guarded. Other practices, for example, the shaking of hands, which was a new activity, also picked up some of the ancient meanings. And this is something that I experienced very much when I would visit small rural churches in Batak land. And at every visit, it was quite important that there be a handshaking. And I would shake the hand of every elder in the church first, every man, and then every married woman, and then the youth. Now, this wasn't the, hello, how are you, isn't the weather fine today type of experience. In fact, very little was said. It was a solemn experience. And if anything was said, it was one word. Horas, which is the Batak equivalent of shalom. There was clearly a sense that there, by virtue of my office, there was sahala to be received in the shaking of hands. In fact, a native Batak pastor has written a monograph on the sahala of the medicine man compared with the sahala of the preacher. The church, the Bataks had a divining calendar that was developed by the medicine men. I'm calling them medicine men. This really isn't fair, but it's the word that we associate with tribal peoples, and there are actually many, many different kinds. There were specialists in healing, there were mediums who could surrender themselves to the spirits, there were priests and a variety of different people with spiritual gifts. But I'm going to call them medicine men simply to avoid confusion. They had a divining calendar to determine the propitious day for planting crops, for harvest, and so on. And of course, the Lutheran churches had their church almanac with the scriptures for the day. And a family had scheduled the wedding of their daughter on a particular day, and only to discover later on that the scripture in the church almanac for that day said, "And Jesus wept over Jerusalem." They quickly changed the date. So, new symbols, totally new things in their experience, in their environment, can bear and carry ancient meanings. Within the theology of the church, the Trinity had quite a struggle to be understood in the way that we understand it. For Trinity immediately was associated with the God of the upper world, the God of the middle world, and the God of the underworld. In fact, the term that the Batak used before the coming of Christianity for the three gods, three God, is the term that they use now for the Trinity, Devatanatolu.
Now, what every missionary hopes to have accomplished, besides the adopting of new symbols and meanings, is for old symbols, and again reminding us that we're thinking of symbols in the broadest sense, even social institutions as being symbols, having new meanings accrue to them. While often attempted, it doesn't always work. In fact, this is a very mysterious process when this occurs. The Baptists in Java, and here we're getting away from the Batak for a second, but the Baptists in Java attempted to set up a Christian festival to replace or coincide with the ancient Javanese harvest festival. Harvest festival was conducted just before the harvest, and within the ancient Javanese tradition, it was a way of not only thanking the spirits for the harvest to come, but also asking their blessing upon the harvest, and making sacrifices and offerings to appease them to bring a good harvest. And the church thought, wow, we'll have a Christian Thanksgiving festival, and adopt this tradition and Christianize it. And we will sing hymns of thanksgiving and hymns of praise to God. What actually developed, or what actually the meaning of this service was, is not really clear. But there were those who became quite critical and said, what we've really done is that we've turned the service itself into the old sacrifice. And here we're no longer trying to sacrifice to and appease the ancestors, but we're trying to sacrifice to and appease God so that he will smile down on us and give us a good harvest. The ancient meaning accruing to the new symbol, whereas the effort was to use the old symbolic system and to infuse it with a new meaning. On the other hand, where this happens, it can be one of the most exciting things, and it is something that can inform our own Christian experience. Getting back to the Batak people and the concept of Sahala belonged to
belongs to people of great power and prestige, people who are in authority over us. And so it was quite common for at Batak festivities, and still is, to invite people of power to come and to be present at a feast with the feeling that we are deemed blessed by their presence. At the opening of church conferences, the governor will be invited, or other top officials, Christian or not, and be invited to give a few opening words. As the Batak Christians, however, read the Beatitudes, and as they looked at the way Jesus dealt with children, this concept of sahala was changed. And it is not at all uncommon now for Bataks to invite orphans into their home from the local orphanage. Not with the sense that they are doing their Christian duty, but with the sense that they are being blessed. For Jesus said, "Let the children come to me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." And so it is the children, it is the poor, it is the widow. It is these are the people now who can be bearers of spiritual blessing to us, and who then we invite into our wealth and into our homes in thanksgiving for the blessing which they bring. On Easter morn, on the first Easter that I was in Indonesia, well, the day before, a friend had come by and said that, asked if I would like to join him for the Easter services, and I said, sure, fine. He said, well, I'll be by real early in the morning to pick you up. Fine. He was by about 4 o'clock in the morning to pick me up. And he took me with his family to the cemetery. And I thought, oh boy, here I'm really going to see this animism at work. Here in the cemetery, there were candles lit and placed on all the graves. And the families of the deceased were kneeling down by the graves. It was still dark. And they were praying and they were singing. And this fellow had invited me to join his family kneeling down by the grave of one of his ancestors. A practice which certainly was similar to, would have been common in the old ancestor cults. But I gradually began to see that there was a totally different set of meanings here. For the prayers were not prayers requesting the blessing of the ancestors. The prayers were prayers of thanksgiving, rejoicing that that their parents were now in the fellowship of Christ, rejoicing in their resurrection, rejoicing in the resurrection of Christ, the rejoicing in the resurrection of us as the community of Christ, community that extended in time back and down into the future. The very fact that I was there, that I was invited to be part of this celebration, meant that this community now was not bound by the genetic line, but it was an all-embracing community. At dawn, the brass band got up, and we marched from the cemetery, all of us, to the church, singing resurrection hymns. Ancient activities, ancient practices, ancient symbols, through which had been discovered a totally new meaning. Perhaps the strongest significance of this for me is that what it says to me is that we are not the bearers of faith. That the activity of Christ is not something which we hold and which we transmit to another people. The activity of Christ is something that occurs among all peoples, and it is the Christians who are attempting to discover it and respond to it. No missionary, no matter how brilliant, ever could have figured out how to translate ancestor worship into resurrection faith. And yet that is what occurred within that environment. I want to do two things, each of which will take half an hour, and we've got 15 minutes. But let's very quickly look at how some of these issues, some of these complex interactions of faith and culture, have been reflected in at various times in the faith of our people. Starting with Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 5. When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you are entering to take possession of it, and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than yourselves, and when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, and show no mercy to them. You shall not make marriages with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons. For they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. But thus you shall deal with them. You shall break down their altars, and dash in pieces their pillars, and hew down their asherim, and burn their graven images with fire. You shall utterly destroy their culture, for their culture would destroy your faith. That's a theme that is quite common in many parts of the Old Testament. There has been a group of missionaries on one of the islands west of Sumatra that has followed that approach, that have said the culture is utterly depraved, that it is of the devil, that this demonology and spirit worship and so on, and the ancestor worship cannot in any way be tolerated, that it is such a potent force of evil that any acceptance of the practices of the people is a temptation for the invasion of the devil. And so to become a Christian in this society, you leave your family entirely. You change your name. You become part of a new family. You have a new identity. You are rejected by your family, and you in turn reject them. Now that isn't the only theme in the Old Testament. I don't want to leave the impression that the Old Testament said that exclusivism is the only way in which we can maintain the purity of our faith in the context of ours or somebody else's culture. The book of Ruth provides quite a different perspective on this. And you know the story of Naomi and Ruth. Because of the famine going to the land of the Moabites. Not Naomi and Ruth. Naomi and her husband going there and having sons and their sons marrying, taking Moabite wives, and then the husband and sons dying, and Naomi, make a very complicated story short, Naomi and Ruth then are deciding to return. Naomi tries to persuade Ruth, who is a widow with no protection, no security, no property, to stay among her own people who can take care of her. Ruth says, "Entreat me not to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. I wonder if we would have the same openness if we were confronted with a situation or the possibility of going to another people in another culture. That if our faith is such that we would be able to totally embrace our new people and know and be aware that God and Christ are active in that context with and with those new understandings. In the New Testament, you see a fascinating way in which Jesus deals with the traditions of his time. Matthew 5, verse 21 and also 27. You have heard that it was said to the men of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to the judgment. But I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to the judgment. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. You have heard that it was said, but I say unto you, adultery, you have heard, is this, but I say to you, adultery is this. A deliberate, conscious taking of the symbolic stuff, the meaning stuff of tradition, and turning it right around and saying, we're going to infuse that symbol with a new meaning. Murder is no longer going to be what you do with your hand. Murder now, that same symbol, is going to carry a new meaning. Murder is what you do with your heart. Adultery isn't what you do with your body alone. Adultery is what you do with your heart. From an anthropological standpoint, Jesus was brilliant. The way he manipulated the symbols of his time. And we might not want to look at it that in that context, but it's interesting to see this happening. Even more powerful, I think, verse 17, think not that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them. Jesus is not setting up a totally different faith system, meaning system. He's not a missionary coming in with a total set of new ideas and say, hey, throw away your old culture and try this. He's saying, what we as a people have hoped for and longed for, and what is the core of our meaning here now is fulfilled. And that, because that strikes at the core of the meaning framework of culture, because it is not peripheral, because it is not a religious issue such as prayer in the public schools, but because it is the cement that holds the entire society together, he gets into a lot of trouble. In Luke chapter 4, he comes to Nazareth and he is speaking in the synagogue. He stands up and he opens the book and he finds the place where it is written, verse 18. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. And he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. The eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed upon him. And he began to say to them, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. Our faith is so broad that it doesn't deal with religious issues. It deals with the longings, it deals with the promises of every aspect of our society. How are we doing on time? If we can whip through a few more of these. In Acts chapter 10, we have this marvelous story of Cornelius. Cornelius, Roman centurion. Unclean, he's not a Jew, who has a vision that he should invite Peter to come to him, to dine with him, and to teach him the faith. And so he sends his servants off to Peter to invite Peter to dinner. Peter, meanwhile, is up at the top of his house and praying. And here in verse 10, "And he became hungry and desired something to eat. But while they were preparing it, he fell into a trance and saw the heaven opened and something descending like a great sheet, let down by four corners upon the earth. In it were all kinds of animals and reptiles and birds of the air. And there came a voice to him, 'Rise, Peter, kill and eat.' But Peter said, 'No, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean.' And the voice came to him again a second time, 'What God has cleansed, you must not call common.' This happened three times, and the thing was taken up at once to heaven." Now Peter was perplexed about that. Three servants from Cornelius came to his house and invited him to dinner. And it still required the Spirit of the Lord to tell Peter, "It's okay, go ahead with them." This, I think, is one of the more humorous stories in the book of Acts, if you think about it. All the things that the Spirit had to do to get this meeting together between Peter and Cornelius. Had to give a special vision to Cornelius, had to give a special vision to Peter, had to repeat it three times over, then had to explain to Peter what he was supposed to do because of the vision when the three men came. And it took three people from Cornelius just to get the message to Peter and to get him back to Cornelius' house. And when finally, when Peter does get over to Cornelius' house, Cornelius has invited all of his friends there to hear the word from Peter. And they all fall down and worship him. And Peter raises them up. And in spite of all of this, Peter says, "You yourselves know how unlawful it is for a Jew to associate with or to visit anyone of another nation." What an insult. "But God has shown me that I should not call any man common or unclean." So deeply rooted are the values by which people live that in this case it took the Spirit a terrific amount of intervention to open up a new vision. And of course we know with Peter's experience then with Cornelius and with Paul's vision that in Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, slave nor free. We have the shattering of a meaning framework which had defined who we belong to, who is good and who is evil, who is accepted and who is not accepted, who can rule and who cannot rule. And we have a revolution in the perception of who we are as a people, which in turn has revolutionized our culture, or the culture of the world. And then we as the church continue to be part of this body that have a vision of the world radically different from the vision of our own cultures. So in 3 minutes, let's play with that statement right there. How radically different is our faith from the vision of our culture? What are some of the visions of our, what are some of the values of our culture? What do we strive for? What do we consider fulfilling? Success.
Bigger is better.
Okay. I'll put bigness.
Okay.
Longevity.
Longevity.
Security.
Security.
Knowledge.
Knowledge.
Physical well-being.
Can I say physical health?
No. Well.
Happiness.
Okay, who are some of our heroes? I should stress at this point that the whole collection of symbols and values and meanings that make up our worldview does not have to be internally consistent.
Okay, what else?
Athletes.
What age groups do we consider it great to be? It's wonderful to be
young.
Movie and TV stars.
Okay. What are some of the principles upon which our nation is based?
Freedom.
Equality. Justice.
Freedom, equality, justice, work. Okay, we could probably go on for some time on this. But let's just take that for a moment. Take any one of those, and let's see how, in the light of the gospel, we would treat that, or we would redefine that. In other words, we could treat any one of these things as a symbol, as a vehicle that can carry much cargo. And let's see if we can redefine it in the light of our faith. To pick one of those you'd like to tackle.
Security.
All right.
I'm going to erase this just so we have some room to work.
Security. What does it mean now? What does it mean to be secure now?
Money.
Money.
Job.
What about the things? A job.
Home.
Strong defense. See, we can treat these concepts either at the individual level or at the corporate group level. All right, let's redefine security in the light of the gospel.
Hope.
Justice.
Okay, let's try to do something rather than just having one word things attached to that, which let's try to work in terms of phrases or sentences or whole concepts. How does hope relate to security in the Christian faith?
Salvation.
Salvation. Are you saying by this, what I seem to be hearing is that we can appeal to people, come to the church and you shall be secure. Have faith in Christ and you'll be saved and you're secure. Is this really what we're saying? Is this what the gospel is?
Like Paul says, nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ.
All right. Okay, let's play with that. Let's play with that a bit. The love of Christ.
I'm wondering if it's okay then, what it says is that we can take all sorts of risks and still feel secure because of our relationship. There's a sense of risk and security that go together.
Okay. So that security permits us the risk. What kind of risks?
Being in God's hands.
But specifically? Give me an example,
well,
an illustration.
Our relationships with other people. We were talking last night about the church being very, the Lutheran church being very ethnic.
Mm-hmm.
We can dare risk our relationship with other people who are totally different than we are. We can take that chance.
Okay.
Well, with the gospel, your security is not based on tangible things of the world, which if you were to lose them, you would lose your basis of security. It's there no matter what your physical surroundings are. And that way that if you were to have, you'll have good security, or if you were to get any of those things on the left, they don't, that doesn't own you, you own it, and you could be just as happy if you did not have it.
Okay. Let's look at what would a person do seeking security in the way that it's been defined in our society. What kinds of things would that person actually do? You're thinking now in terms of our American society. People who seek security do what?
Buy insurance.
Buy insurance?
Acquire things. Save.
Invest. Work.
Educate.
How do they vote? What programs do they vote for? All right, don't have to answer that question. Would defining security in the light of the gospel, particularly looking at this, would that cause a person to act any differently? And if so, where would those differences be? What would they do differently?
John Schramm mentioned that he has never accepted as much as the congregation has offered him. He's willing to take less in order to be
taking
the
less
person he wants to be.
Okay.
Not quite as concerned about your own situation as you are about risking giving and caring for others. And security doesn't come from trying to acquire all these things yourself, but your security comes in being, in terms of fitting in to the rest of life, in terms of giving and sharing and all of those things.
Well, we have run out of time. And this little exercise we've done here is a way of saying that our faith does address our culture, and our faith addresses the culture at the point of the most of the things that we take most seriously most of the time. And if it is that in our faith we are to discover the Christ of history, then we will discover it, discover him, her, in the context of what is most important to our people most of the time. In the same way that Jesus said, "You have heard it said of old, but I say unto you," we will be able likewise to say, "We have heard that it was said of old, but now we can say," and live accordingly. Thank you very much.